Good morning and welcome back to Going Green with Bob DeLuca. I'm Bob DeLuca, president of Group for the East End, and I want to thank you for joining me today on 88.3 WPPB for an enlightening discussion about the valuable role that art can play in our understanding of environmental issues facing the world around us and in providing us with the inspiration we need to bring about lasting environmental change in our homes, our communities, and across the globe. You know, over the years, I've worked on dozens, if not hundreds, of environmental issues and campaigns, and I've always been taken by the value of artistic media in telling the story, both good and bad, about the environmental conditions we have around us and some of the outcomes of the environmental project and some of the environmental problems that we see, as well as the tremendous power that visual messages can have in shaping our awareness and understanding of the need for environmental protection and restoration. As a biologist, I know firsthand how difficult it can be to describe something like, say, a toxic algae bloom or a contaminated groundwater plume to the average person. But all I need to do is show a single picture of what a bloom of brown tide or red tide looks like in our local bays, or what contaminated water looks like coming out of a faucet, and the understanding is immediate. At the same time, one beautiful image of what we have to lose can evoke a passionate commitment to preservation or a call to action to even the most disinterested observer. And of course, it's more than just pictures. Artistic interpretation, whether by impressionistic painting, photograph, collage, or sculpture, gives us all the experience of the environment or environmental issues through a number of varied structures or images that tell a story or describe a problem that can compel us to learn more about any particular project. For me, and as the world moves ever more quickly and people have less and less time to see and reflect on the world around them, I think visual imagery will play an increasingly powerful and important role in our absorption and assimilation of all information. I'm more and more convinced that over time, the role of environmental art will prove to be one of the most powerful tools we have for raising awareness and moving people to action. On today's program, we have a unique opportunity to speak with two widely recognized East End environmental artists and find out where they got their inspiration, how their art has impacted their own environmental thinking, how their work has affected others, and what they see as the linkage between art and advocacy in their own lives. And as we get underway, I just want to thank the Richard King Mellon Family Foundation for underwriting this program and WPPB for its commitment to building a community radio station that serves as an accessible and informative voice for the East End and Connecticut coastline. And remember, if you want to join the discussion anytime today, you can post your questions to the 88.3 WPPB Facebook page anytime during the show. You can also listen to this program live and online at 883WPPB.org. Now to get things started, it's my pleasure to introduce today's guest. First, I'd like to welcome Catherine Zoka. Catherine's a graduate of the University of Maryland with a degree in mathematics, bless you, and studied photography at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. Today, she's a freelance and fine art photographer known for her Vanishing Landscape series, which chronicles the changing East End landscape. An ardent naturalist, Catherine's widely known for her exceptional work photographing many East End fields, farms, wetlands, bays, beaches, and harbors. Catherine teaches photography at art schools across the Northeast and is also the co-owner of Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. You can see some of Catherine's beautiful photography at oneeyeopen.catherinezoka.wordpress.com. And be sure to check out the Canio's Bookstore face page as well. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
Also in the studio today is Anne Seelbach. Anne is a graduate of NYU, Hunter College, and developed her work nationally and internationally at such renowned institutions as the McDowell Colony and the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. Anne has also taught at the University of Rhode Island, Northeastern University, Emerson College, and the Parrish Art Museum. Anne has been inspired by the coastal environment of Eastern Long Island and the mysteries of nature where land and water meet. Anne, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have both of you folks here today because many times this program we deal with these sort of hefty policy issues and you know, all of the intricacies of trying to build support for environmental campaigns. But one of the most powerful things that reaches people is art. And the work that you all do is obviously front and center in that area. And I wanted to start off a little bit about asking you how it is that your own artistic, pursuits brought you to the environmental issues. And Catherine, maybe I could start with you, given all of your photography about here on the East End.
Okay, so how did my art lead me to my activism is the question. Well, first of all, I have to say that I've done a lot of work with the group over the years, and I'd like to just congratulate Bob, your organization, for what you have done. It's really been a lifesaver for a lot of what's precious out here in the East End. When I first came to the East End in the early 80s, I have to say I was thunderstruck by the beauty of the area. It was an immediate visceral connection and a passion for the look of the farmlands, for the waterways that we have. And I think one of the roles that artists assume in our culture is appeeling back the layers of the onion and having the ability to go deep from what's on the surface to what's within the core, which means on the surface things seem disconnected, but at the core things are connected. So my art, my photography of the farm fields was a way for me to say, okay, at the surface it's beautiful, but let me go deeper and let me find out about what will these farmlands look like in 20 years. And so that reflection, that contemplation about that led me to find out that indeed on the maps it showed they would become suburban developments. And I felt at that moment, you know, I needed to become engaged in the dialogue about how do we prevent that, or how do we plan the area in a way that allows for the beauty to be maintained and for people to peacefully coexist there.
And you raise an interesting issue, because so many times people will give us a call and they'll say there's this beautiful farm field and suddenly it's now developed. And the reality is that subdivision may well have been on the books for many years, and but people don't know. And you drive by it and you assume it's going to be that way forever. And what your work has done is to show us that things do change. And with a knowledge of that history, we have some sense as to where we're heading and maybe some of the things that we need to do to change the future direction that we're going, well, you know, whenever that's possible.
Right. Well, I will just interject at that point that after taking a number of photographs of the beautiful farm fields in the 80s here, I went to the group's offices in Bridgehampton to take a look at what the underlying maps were, and I was really shocked, and it jolted me into making more of a stand with my art about the environment. And each and every one of us can do that wherever we are, with whatever our own talents are.
And I think more and more, as the area becomes developed and people have less of a personal experience with those fields from the 1980s, it's critical to have that historical perspective to show people what was here and why people like you and me and Dan care about those things. And Ann, let me ask you a little bit about your transition in your art and how you came to focus time, energy, and attention on environmental issues in the work that you did.
Well, my painting has always been about nature. And I'm interested in what's happening behind the scene. In other words, you have this lovely scene or not lovely scene. What are the natural forces creating it? Or recently, what are the unnatural sources? And I'd been painting the images of the shoreline or the gulls and the crabs and everything. And one day, about 3 years ago, I was looking down into the water of the Sag Harbor Cove, Upper Sag Harbor Cove, and I saw this very peculiar fish. So my beginning starts with observation. And I saw this fish that was like a pencil, was long and thin and had an eye in the middle of its body and almost no fins at all, very rudimentary. And I thought, this is very peculiar and it doesn't look like anything I know about. And I had been reading in the past about changes in nature because of chemicals like frogs with three legs and other animals that had their reproductive systems compromised because of chemicals. And I thought before, oh, well, that's, you know, somewhere else.
Right.
It's not here. It's somewhere else. And I knew about it, but I didn't have a feeling. And all of a sudden, I was looking at something that made me think, maybe this is like starting. And so I did a drawing of it right there. And that drawing and the thought behind this, and then I became more aware of articles in the local newspaper about what was happening with toxic chemicals going into the water. But it started a whole series, which is 3 years now, of painting what I call the troubled waters. So I think what happens is you start, or one starts with an image, either as an artist and then activates a painting or a photograph, or as a person just seeing something that's in your direct experience, and then all of a sudden becoming more aware of other things that relate to it. And you sort of gain knowledge as time goes by. And I think and then when you realize that water is crucial and your life depends on it, then it becomes much more urgent. So
now your Troubled Water series, which I've seen, which is really a neat kind of art that you've done there. Maybe you could describe that a little bit and how you tell the story of what's going on in our waters with the unique art style that you have there.
Well, I have paintings, works on papers, and now cutouts, which I will not talk about probably. The first ones are paintings of the marine environment, suggesting water and fish, but using also hard edge forms or in some cases automobile gaskets, stencil form to suggest man-made substances in the water. You may not know what they are, but there's something not natural about this water. Mm-hmm. And then the fish sometimes look like real fish, sometimes are abstracted. I would use like plastic gutter mesh to suggest scales on the fish, and sometimes totally imaginary, like just whatever the gesture creates. So they're, like I say, on paper or canvas. You were very kind to show them in an exhibition in 2012 at your gallery space, and that it has grown from there. Now I'm taking that and actually getting rid of the frame and the edge and having the paper or the materials themselves become it, so you don't have glass behind. You're really just directly connected to the work. So that's sort of...
I mean, I found in looking at your work very interesting that you were able to take sort of a chemical diagram, chemical formula...
Yes, and actually molecular structure.
And work that into the art, and it worked so well.
Yeah.
And it immediately, whether you're a chemist or not, I mean, it immediately connected you to the idea that there is this thing in the water that doesn't belong here. And I wonder, what kind of reaction do you get from people when they see that work? Is there anything that you've picked up in terms of how that affects people?
Yes. Some people, if they look quickly, they just don't get it. But the ones who look at it are attracted to it, and then sort of like, there's this like, oh. So it's a kind of realization that you're looking at something that isn't quite what you thought it was about water and fish, but it isn't quite. And then you look at the forms and know, well, that's not natural. It, the more you look, the more you realize this isn't what I thought it was in the beginning. And at that point, either you're really drawn into it or really not. So I've had people either say, oh, that's so pretty, or that's so horrendous, I can't believe it. So,
right.
You know, it's...
But it has an effect.
It has an effect.
Which is excellent. Yeah. And Catherine, in terms of your work, now I've seen some of your beautiful landscape work, and I've always wondered whether or not work that shows the landscape in such a beautiful way is compelling, or is it a placebo that kind of says, oh, this is great, these pictures are terrific, so I can not have to worry about it so much. What's your experience been of people looking at your work, and how has that moved them, do you think, one way or the other?
Well, I think that the work, as I said earlier, I was attracted to the beauty of the area, and that was sort of one of the wellsprings from which my photography came. I consider myself now as having been drawn to the light, and the light on the East End is almost just sort of miraculous. It's really quite beautiful, and I think everyone would agree with that. And over time, I have come to equate the spirit with that light. So how do people respond to my work? I think that one of the best compliments I get from people is that when they see a photograph of a landscape that they may have been driven by literally every day, going back and forth to work hundreds of times, then they see my photograph and they say, wow, I never really appreciated that landscape until I saw how you captured it. The art of photography, I think, is really well suited to helping people actually stop, kind of as Anne said, like they do in front of her paintings, and contemplate, what is this that I'm looking at? So a good photograph is one that holds people's eyes for longer than a few seconds. And I think many of my photographs, fortunately, are able to do that. When people see that, when they see how beautiful it is, the work is, and then when they look around and see what is happening to potentially destroy that particular scene, then they are, I think that motivates them to action. I think there's a place in art for showing both beauty and also showing the side that is ugly. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's all needed and necessary, and it each appeals to people on a different level, and I think it's a visceral level for both.
I know that some of your work also focuses on people and lifestyle and where they live, and I wonder how much does it matter for us to make sure that we show people in their environment as opposed to the environment as a, you know, something that we look at from afar? And how is the work that you've done, you know, shaped by just interacting with people in their daily lives and their daily environment?
Well, having people in photographs, I think, is a wonderful way to express a mood, an emotion, a feeling. And I guess I'd like to say, just as a way of background, the Vanishing Landscape series led me to other works that I have been that I have done over the several years. The first one I'll mention is the Quail Hill Farm. Mm-hmm. And Quail Hill Farm is a preserved location. It's a CSA. Through the generosity, I'll say, of Deborah Ann Light, if she listens to this down in Florida, thank you for doing that. She donated the property to the Peconic Land Trust. When I started photographing on Quail Hill Farm, I thought I would mostly be photographing landscapes. I went there every week for almost the whole year. And as the essay developed, it really became more about the people there. And so that was, for me, an interesting turning point to have me recognize that the story is not just about the land, it's also about a lot about the people and their interaction with the land. So I have since then done many essays that photograph people. I like to consider that I photograph communities in transition. Mm-hmm. And so I have photographed a number of communities like that, showing both the land and the people interacting with the land.
I also find, and Ann, maybe I'll get your perspective on this too, the for many people, the their experience of, you know, water pollution or something like that is so abstract. And your art in some ways is also kind of abstract in mm-hmm. the way that you show it. Mm-hmm. But how is it that where do you start when you decide to do something like use molecular structure in a piece of art? You know, what are the things that, where within you do you find the pieces that you're going to assemble that are going to tell that story? How does that work for an artist?
Well, I've done both abstract painting and representational painting. And when you do abstract painting, totally abstract, you start with the elements of art, which are color, line, form, rhythm, balance, texture, many things. So I start the paintings like I did my abstract paintings years ago. So you have a huge white canvas or a piece of paper that's prepared, and you start with a stroke. And then you work into that painting according to what's already there. So it's nonverbal. Mm-hmm. I just have to say, you start adding color washes or line, or you happen to collect things. So you've got a piece of plastic mesh, and you can use it as a kind of base and have a stipple brush and, you know, make a kind of stencil thing. Or I use whatever's around. I've even used plastic cloth that I find on the beach, and it's sort of ragged, and you put, you know, dribble it in paint and sort of just make marks. You start and you just build it up and build up, and then there, some shapes suggest a form like a fish. Mm-hmm. So you follow that. Sometimes it's more like an abstracted or a mutated fish, so you mm-hmm. follow that. And it works basically on a yes-no system. Mm-hmm. You do something, and you further your idea, and you do something else, and it goes, nope, that's not it. And then you do something else again. And it just goes back and forth, yes and no, and continue until it's done. And it could be done in a day, in a week, in several months. It depends on the size, on the materials. If it's oil, obviously it's going to take long to dry, mm-hmm. so you have to allow time for that
right.
between sessions and all. And it's very hard to describe that process, mm-hmm. but it's just you and the work in the studio.
And Catherine, your work now, and I know very little about photography, so forgive me, but I mean, I assume I know when I try to take pictures.
Everyone thinks they're an expert in photography, yeah. So why not you?
I wonder if, now in your case, you're almost wrestling back and forth with an image that you're trying to capture or that you're trying to show in whatever conditions are in front of you, right? So it's a two-way street in terms of what the environment presents to you. Do you find that, is it a struggle? Is it easier? Does it challenge you to try to find a way to fit what you're seeing into that image versus what the world is presenting to you?
Well, it's interesting. As you mentioned, I teach photography, and listening to Anne talk about her process, I mean, one of the points I make is that with art, often you start with a blank canvas, and you have to bring it all there. With photography, you're really editing out. It's almost the opposite approach because you have the world in front of you, an infinity of angles to choose and select from. So you are not building up, you are editing out. So that's one of the distinctions, I think, between the two approaches. But I think at the core of both approaches is the need for some sort of contemplation, some sort of time. I mean, Anne talks about being in the studio, you know, hour in, hour out, day in, day out, week in, week out. Now, with photography, the time is not measured in the same increments. However, it is a process of contemplation because I will know areas I want to photograph, but I have to make sure I go to that particular area at a particular time of year, time of day, type of weather. And then when I get there, I have to actually be immersed in that geography, walking around, looking for the angles, waiting for the light. So it's a very meditative process that is undertaken in order to make good photographs. I mean, anyone can get out of their car with their iPhone and snap a photograph, which I encourage people to do, and that's great. But in terms of being able, for me, to capture the right composition at the right time of day with the right light, it requires patience. It requires slowing myself down in order to be able to find it. Now, I'm not sure that answered your question.
No, it does, and it actually, there's two things that it got me thinking about. One of them is, you know, I always think, and I've done some teaching as well, and there's this line, and I don't know where it came from, but they say, if you ask kindergartners who can sing, they all raise their hands. And by the time you get to fourth or fifth grade, you ask them who can sing, and nobody raises their hand, or maybe one kid, you know, who's in the play. I'm trying to figure out how, with the work that you do and the teaching that you've done, you know, do we all have a little artist in us, and what do we do to free that up? Like, I mean, people experience the environment in so many ways, yet I think we're all terrified to think that we can put that on paper or maybe even take a picture that's worth something, even if it's just to us. How do you find in your teaching that you get people to, you know, out of that place where they don't think they could do it anymore?
Well, I think that all people have an artistic ability. It's not all equal. So not everybody is going to be a Ann Seelbach, you know, or an April Gornick. However, it's there. And I think that in our culture, it's not it's not cultivated. And so what I try to get people to recognize in photography is that we all have our own point of view, and we all have the particular way in which we look at the world. And we need to get acquainted with that. And other art teachers or writing teachers that I know often go back to a point that I do, which is to get out of the monkey mind. And if you want to be able to pursue art to a level of competence, you have to be able to give yourself time and the lack of distractions in order to be able to appreciate whatever it is you want to do. If it's taking a photograph that has specific meaning, writing a short essay, or making a drawing. I think contemplation and time is key, and then from there, the experience of teaching can then help people use whatever tools they are, be it camera or be it paintbrush, to their fullest capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Anne?
Well, I teach at the Art Barge in the summertime, and I run across the same problem of people coming, they're interested, but they're so rattled by maybe even getting out to Napeague. But there needs to be a period of just calming down. Like, we're here now, you know, nothing. Forget about your house guests. Forget about everything else. We're here. And basically, I try to tell people, first of all, to just look. Just look. And then we'll do things, of a couple of exercises to start, which are to think differently visually. In other words, we all see things. We see things. Okay, but we don't always look at the space between things. But if you're making a painting, you've got to consider that as well. So we'll do an exercise where we have just a piece of paper and paint and no money involved in this. This is a cheap piece of paper, mm-hmm. and we're just going to try to get this idea. And I have them paint, not draw, but paint the spaces between things, because that has a shape. And it's like a whole change of perception. So that helps. It's like, oh, we're in a different territory now.
And I want to, we're going to go to a break in a minute, but one of the things I want to talk just a little bit about before we do is, do you think that the discipline and maybe the meditative experience that you've had in doing what you do has allowed you to connect more with the environment than maybe some of the people who you see in your classes? I mean, you do it, like, it seems like this is, there's a process to get an environmental appreciation, and I wonder if the work that you all do has helped you in any way to make that transition a little easier.
Yes, I think so. In fact, I realized, I was looking over what I've done, you know, over the years, sort of to prepare for this a little bit, and I realized I've been doing this kind of thing, looking at the environment wherever I am, for at least 30, 35 years. And I lived in Jersey City at one point, and it became urban landscape because I lived next to chemical factories. Mm. And they had garbage and stuff, and they would, you know, have stencils that they would label the barrels, and I would take those and incorporate that into my art, the titles, the numbers, whatever. It just, it's like, it's landscape, but interpreted landscape.
Exactly.
And I would just like to say that my relationship to nature goes back to when I was young, and I think it has informed my art and deepened it, and my art has deepened my appreciation of nature. And I think that's why I really feel it's important for young people to have direct experiences with nature that are unedited or unprogrammed, so that they can also develop that. It's like developing a muscle in the body or the brain. You know, you need to have that experience in order for it to grow.
Excellent. And on that, I think we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about the transition from art to advocacy. And you're listening to Going Green with Bob DeLuca. My guests today are Ann Seelback, artist and landscape photographer, Catherine Zocca.
When you're down and out, when you're on the street, when evening falls so hard, I will comfort you.
Support for WPPB Peconic Public Broadcasting comes in part from the Southampton Inn, featuring Valentine's Day packages, including an overnight stay, catered dinner by Brent Newsom, complimentary wine, and breakfast for two the following morning. Roses and chocolate-covered strawberries are available at your request. Additional information and reservations at 631-283-6500 or online at southamptoninn.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, if you're planning on making chili for the Super Bowl, we've got the recipes for you, no matter what you like.
Beans, no beans, pork, beef, just vegetables, killer spicy, mild and smoky, no one agrees.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Listen weekdays at noon on 88.3 Peconic Public Broadcasting.
Support for WPPB comes in part from the Awning Company of Sag Harbor, featuring motorized shading systems, solar screens, storm shutters, and more. Visitors are welcome at the Awning Company's Design Center, 1668 Sag Harbor Turnpike. Information is available by phone at 631-725-3651 or online at theawningcompany.com. The Awning Company, where awnings are more than just shade.
Time to saddle up and ride on American Roots to the Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada, to meet Yodel King Wiley Gustafson. Then out on the Louisiana Trail with Creole cowboy Gino Delafosse, plus songs and stories from buckaroos and cowhunters. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for Cowboy Culture on American Roots from PRX.
Listen every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on 88.3 Peconic Public Broadcasting. Support for WPPB comes from Bridgehampton National Bank. BNB is committed to helping local businesses stay on top of their competitive challenges. With long-term partnerships, local decision-making, and an understanding of the marketplace, BNB community lenders and branch managers help their customers succeed every day. BNB, many success stories, one bank. Information at bridgenb.com. Equal Opportunity Lender, member FDIC.
Hi, and welcome back to Going Green with Bob DeLuca. I'm Bob DeLuca, president of Group for the East End, and my guests today are artist Ann Seelback and landscape photographer Catherine Zoka. By the way, if you've been listening to the show and you'd like to know where you can see some of the wonderful work that both of these two artists have, you can check out Catherine Zoka's work at One Eye Open, Catherine Zoka, S-Z-O-K-A, at WordPress.com, and Ann Seelback at AnnSeelback.com, A-N-N-E-S-E-L-B-A-C-H. com. And this morning we've been talking about the importance of art as one vehicle in terms of environmental advocacy and our environmental understanding. And when we went out just before the break, we were talking about, Catherine, your early life experiences and how that kind of mobilized you or got you interested in these things. And in the second half of the program, I want to talk a little bit about moving our understanding or our ability with art toward advocacy and when that started for you and how it's affected you and maybe how it's affected others around you. So maybe, Catherine, we'll start with you and then we'll go from
there.
Sure.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the program, that really began out here with the Vanishing Landscape series. I mean, first of all, the selection of that as a title for the work was a statement that this is not just pretty photographs that we're looking at. It was a recognition that we were looking at farmland that was potentially perishable. And that actually came from experiences that I had as a youth growing up in Maryland and seeing similar things happening, growing up really at the end of a farm field myself, watching development occur as I grew. But coming into the present, you know, when I first arrived here, I decided to call it Vanishing Landscapes, and that immediately put the work, it's like the fork in the road. Because I decided to have that as a title, that started me down a road that was making a statement that had a political or an activist point of view. First of all, I think work with a point of view is critical. It doesn't necessarily have to have an activist tinge to it, but I think that it makes it stronger. And so over the years, as I was developing the work, I became more closely affiliated myself with the group for the South Fork, did a number of presentations for you, mm-hmm. went to a lot of town board meetings. And the idea of getting involved and being active is not something that people should think happens at, like, warp factor 5.
Right.
You know, you start small and you grow. And so looking back now, I see how the evolution was just a step-by-step evolution.
So that one of the questions that occurred to me, and I guess maybe you just answered it, is so you didn't have necessarily an activist or advocacy point of view as you did your art. From the art, it came along with it.
It did. I did not pick up the camera initially to say I'm going to make a statement with the photographs that I take in Vanishing Landscape.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the initial impetus.
Hmm.
The initial passion and impetus came from the beauty of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And because I really felt a connection with the beauty of the landscape, and then became aware that that landscape would be altered, I needed to educate myself to figure out what I could do to help positively affect the dialogue that was happening about how that change occurred.
Hmm. And Ann, how about for you? Did you have sort of an advocacy part of your nature or character before you went into art, or did it come along as the art developed?
No, I didn't think about that at all, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think when I started painting landscape, but from the point of view of what am I seeing, in other words, the truth of what I was seeing, not mm-hmm. like a pretty mm-hmm. scene, even though sometimes it was beautiful, mm-hmm. that it became more substantial and also more connected to the world somehow. And then I also found that there were groups out here that encouraged that. Art groups that, like the East End Arts Council, mm-hmm. for example, they're not commercial galleries. They allow you to do what you do, and so it can grow. In other words, there's encouragement that way. I would say also like the Islip Art Museum does fabulous shows that are just way off the charts sometimes. And there's no restriction, either overt or self-imposed. So then also the other thing that happened was, I had started this series, but then we had a couple of really bad storms and then the hurricane, mm-hmm. where I did not have water. mm-hmm. And
an apt metaphor for
well, I tell you, it changes yeah. a lot. You realize that there are people all over the world who don't have easy access to water or clean water. And it becomes real if you experience it yourself. So I don't know. I talk about the work. I show it as in many places as possible. I mean, right now it's at the South Huntington Public Library. Mm-hmm. They've got a show called Troubled Waters. And it just seems like the more it's out there and people know what you do and you show it more and more and people talk to you and you talk to them about what your experience is, and then they sometimes tell you what their experience is. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it's not like a rabble-rousing thing. It's just more like, we live here and this is what is. What are we going to do?
Right, right.
So that's just... It's sort of a quiet way of being an activist.
And do you find with your students that students, again, come through a variety of different doorways? Some maybe have an advocacy perspective coming in, some
right.
develop it, some don't.
All over the board.
Okay.
And then they just come and basically experience the land and the water. And I think that's one of the incredible things about the Art Barge, just being there just right. changes your whole life, because you'd leave everything at the highway mm-hmm. and just come, and it's sort of like coming down a level and you just relax and look.
The more that you do and the more that you know, do you feel a greater obligation? I mean, what you're doing now is of great benefit. Do you find yourself feeling more obligation as time goes on with the more that you do and the more that you see to keep moving in the direction of advocacy with your art? Or do you kind of do it for a while and then maybe move off to something else? Either anybody.
Well, I'm going to continue this for a while because it seems to grow. But I'm also thinking about the land itself as something that I need to address in a kind of spiritual sense. Maybe it's the same thing, but just mm-hmm. in another way, that there is an incredible mystery to things that we just, nobody has time for anymore. But I think a painting is a way of slowing down time for the viewer, that they because it's not like an illustration. So you have to understand and sort of interpret mm-hmm. what you see a little bit. And that helps it a bit. So it's like, yes, this is the truth right now, and I want to continue expressing that. But I also want to go on to this other idea, which is like, appreciating and honoring what we've got.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, full disclosure, you know, I was with the League of Women Voters mm-hmm. During the 80s at the time that I was starting the Vanishing Landscapes work. So I have been active on a non-artistic level, if you want to call it that, for a long time. And I feel it's very much a part of who I am, mm-hmm. and I continue it daily. As many people may know, at the bookstore, we've been offering a number of really terrific workshops sponsored by the Northwest Earth Institute on different aspects of environmentalism. Right now we're doing climate change, and we've done voluntary simplicity and reconnecting with nature. And that grows out of, you know, our mission to try to have community gather in a way where we can discuss in a positive way what we can do to affect making the world a better place, you know, from, you know, just small, simple steps to, you know, lobbying down in Washington and things of that nature. But I do think that art and photography in particular has, because of the fact that you can take the visual in instantaneously, has the capacity to transform people's hearts and minds in a way that reading even a letter to the editor or listening to somebody at a podium just cannot necessarily get across. And so as one of my talents, I look to continue to use that for that purpose.
Do either of you find that in this busy world that Anne mentioned before, and we talked a little bit before we came on air about that, how quickly things move, how much information is beaming at us in all directions all the time, is it harder to find people's time, basically, to see your work? Or do you find any change in that? Or are the people that are coming to galleries already okay enough that they could spend 5 minutes looking at a painting and not be running out the door? Have you seen a change?
I don't think anyone has any. They have such a short attention span, everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, myself included sometimes. There's so much information coming in on all levels, computer, television, life, you know. And so many situations where you have to make a decision soon without contemplating things. I think getting people to simply slow down, and whether it's looking at a painting or looking at their backyard or looking at the beach. I went there yesterday. There was 2 inches of snow on the sand, and it was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Just slowing down and looking. Because that's where it starts, whether you end up being making a painting or you realize, like, this is where I live and this is what's going on. It's slowing down enough to actually realize what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the culture is changing. I mean, we're moving forward rapidly in terms of our technology. And so the way people take in art is much different today than it was 20 or 40 years ago. You know, that said, I have noticed people still love to go to a gallery. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is just something that is, like people are taking digital holidays now, I think people are recognizing the need that they have to get out, they have to be in a gallery, they have to look at art. I think the art market has changed with the recession. I think it's more challenging for artists to actually make a living selling art. That's why everyone teaches and has second and third jobs. However, I do believe that people want art, they need art, they seek it out on the web. I think that in and of itself, that's sort of a neutral location. But I think if people can be brought more art to their eyes by looking there, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Do your experiences leave you more hopeful, or are we in deeper trouble, or how does what you do and what you see affect your future outlook, both in terms of the art that you produce and maybe the message that you convey to people with the art that you have?
I'll jump in there and say, you know, the world is full of competing forces. We have always had what's not good and what is good in a constant ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
So I choose to be positive. It's a choice that I make.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we are, in today's world, at nearing a tipping point when things will be improved in terms of how we, you know, cosmically or at least globally look at issues like climate change. And a lot of the ability for me to look at things positively is because I have lately developed more of a spiritual aspect to my world. And I think that that component helps keep despair at bay, and I think it's critical. And so that's how I choose to, I make a choice to be positive.
Mm-hmm. And how about you?
I'm optimistic too. I think that enough has been raised about this, maybe not enough, but a lot, about the water pollution and the fact that Long Island has basically one aquifer and there's no plan B. If we screw this up, it's like the end. I think people are taking it very seriously. I mean, I've had people say to me, okay, I agree. I agree with what you're saying, but how can I, if I have to take a sample of the water from my sink, where do I go to get a test on it? And I don't actually know the answer to that. But anyway, I feel that I think it will progress in the right direction. And I think that nature also has its way of working around things. This is not the first time it's been endangered. And, I mean, one of my favorite subjects is the horseshoe crab, which is like 2 million years old, and mm-hmm. it has survived an awful lot. Now, I know that's also a little bit of a dangerous mm-hmm. problem right now, but I feel it's going to work out. But mm-hmm. we've got to pay attention to ensure that that happens.
Okay.
And I'll just say, look, things are dire. I'm not Pollyanna over here, mm-hmm. But I do feel that, if I would want to convey a message to people listening out there, it's that, we are the lifeboat, and everyone, if everyone gets in it, and works, we're going to be okay.
On the in an act of shameless promotion here, we talked about water a little bit, and I just encourage people to check out a new website, the Long Island Clean Water Partnership website. And if you just go to the Long Island Clean Water Partnership.org, there is the good news is we have a regional campaign underway working with some of the largest conservation organizations on Long Island: Citizens Campaign for the Environment, Nature Conservancy, Pine Barren Society, Group for the East End, and lots of other local organizations who are committed to this water issue. And that's a place where people can find some information. And on the well testing, the Suffolk County Department of Health Services has a very affordable, very thorough well test that people can get done in the neighborhood of probably less than $200, if I'm not mistaken, significantly less than maybe a private company. And you can find out what's in your water. And if you have a well, you should get it checked once in a while just to be on the safe side. But circling back around, I guess I'd like to ask each of you if you had, the magic wand and you were to give some advocacy advice through the lens of an artist. What should we learn from what you do that helps all of us advance the cause of conservation? Just any thoughts that you have?
Well, I think one thing would be to learn that anyone can do this. I'm not really special in any respect. Anybody can take – everyone has talents, and each of us should take the talent that we have and to try to use it in a way that affects the globe. And I'll just put in there that one thing we haven't discussed at all is income inequality, mm-hmm. and I think that that is a big challenge to what is happening in the environment out here today. In many ways, and that is an underlying issue that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Anne?
I think I agree with Catherine that everyone has a skill or a talent, and that starting from where you are and from what your knowledge is and what you've observed on your own, and then reading more and becoming more familiar with any environmental issue is a start. And then you just by being out here, especially, there are so many groups doing so many things, you're aware of them, and it's easy to get involved. And it's you don't have to, start waving flags or anything. You just become part of it and find out what's going on and how, in the many ways that they offer opportunities, you might want to be involved. It's not so hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just like to say, it's a great way to find community.
Mm-hmm.
Go for a walk that the group sponsors or the trails organizations do, and then you meet people and then just talk. There's nothing more powerful than that.
Yeah. Well, I think what I find so fascinating about talking with both of you is that very frequently we talked about this a little bit earlier. You end up in the grind of the process of any activity, any campaign. There is a certain part of it. That is not aesthetic. And I just love the idea that in the work that you do and so many other local artists that we have out here who focus on the beauty and the challenges that we face with respect to the environment, I think we all have an opportunity that a lot of people would never have to see art in a way that we can be moved by, that can inspire us, that can help us to see the hope that's out there in the world around us if we slow down long enough. And as somebody who sometimes finds myself running probably faster than I should be and not being able to slow down enough, I'm so glad that I was able to have, you know, both of you in here today, because it really is it's a wonderful opportunity. And, of course, the work that you do is just so terrific. And we are just about out of time, which is kind of hard to believe either. But before I go, I really want to thank both of you, Catherine Zocca, fine art and landscape photographer. And I want, again, let people know where they can find your work, again, at the One I Open, Catherine Zocca at WordPress.com, and Canio's Books also, which is not only a great place for books, but a great place for programs, environmental programs, and just a wonderful local business in Sag Harbor that everyone should be happy to support, because you guys have great stuff. And Catherine, of course, is a co-owner, right? Is that there?
I am, and my work is there for people who want to see it. And if I could just plug the Plein Air Pecanic Group I belong to, has a show at Ashwa in May.
Great. And Ann Sealback at AnnSealback.com. We can see more of your work. And again, your Troubled Waters series is terrific. And it's taught me a lot about the many ways that we can look at the environment and art. And I want to thank you so much. And I also want to thank Kyle Lynch, WPPV President, and Station Director Wally Smith, my wonderful co-producer and radio mentor Bonnie Grice, along with everybody here at WPPV, for all of the help and support they provide in pulling this show together. And for more information about a number of nature outings and explorations that you can enjoy right here on the East End of Long Island, please check out groupfortheeastend.org to sign up for one of our upcoming nature events, or check out some of the many environmental programs and advocacy campaigns that we undertake to protect and restore the natural resources of Eastern Long Island. Have a great day, and join me next month for another edition of Going Green on WPPB.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.